open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
I think that a fiction writer has to go those places that ordinary lives don't enter.
Welcome to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Elizabeth Strout says one of the reasons she writes fiction is to experience life from another perspective.
You know, the fact that we only see the world from our own point of view is, it's always made me so upset because I just want to know what it feels like to be another person, so I have to make it up.
Elizabeth Strout is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author who has written 5 novels, including Olive Kittredge and My Name is Lucy Barton. Her latest book is Anything is Possible. Elizabeth talks this hour with actor and fellow writer Benjamin Bush. Strout told Bush she started writing at an early age.
My mother, when I was really young, she bought me those, do they still have those notebooks that, you know, really wide space notebooks with the little dashes in the middle? Anyway, yeah. That's what she bought me, and she would say, write down what you did today. So I would.
And did you always write down what you did?
What I did.
Did you ever write down anything you imagined someone else doing?
No.
So it was, that came later.
That was straight autobiography.
Which is interesting because you haven't written memoir.
What?
Really?
No.
Lucy Barton did.
Lucy Barton wrote a memoir.
Have you ever thought about writing a memoir?
No.
What frightens you about that?
You know, It's just not what I want to do. I want to get inside other people's heads. Yeah. My head is like, whatever. You know, whatever. I just want to enter other people's heads.
You're always watching people. You would have been a great spy.
Yeah, I might have been. Well, I would have been too scared. Yeah. But I would have otherwise been a good spy. I hadn't been scared.
Agent Q, observe people and write something about their entire lives based on a first impression.
Yeah. No, I watch people all the time. I just find people so interesting.
And somehow you have an incredible category of observations that you've had in the world. Like 2 years later, someone you saw on the subway will appear and become someone important to you. You begin to imbue your characters with this fictional world. Mm-hmm. How do you store people like that? How do you recall them?
You know, I really don't know, but you're talking about, I guess when you and I spoke about...
Right. Right,
a number of years ago, I was riding on the subway and I saw this couple, and the young woman was sitting on her boyfriend's lap, and she said, stop sniffing me, I know you're sniffing me. And I thought, they're so cute. And she was wearing a little denim jacket that had fake fur, you know. And I just watched them. And then probably about 4 or 5 years later, they showed up in the story called Starving in Olive Kittredge. That's the couple. And I put them right there. And I even have the girl sitting on the boyfriend's lap. And I have her having that same jacket. And I have her saying, stop sniffing me. And then I realized later on, oh, okay, it's because they're going to have been smoking marijuana. That's why she's sniffing him. But anyway, you know, but the visual that I had was that couple on the subway from so many years earlier. I had no idea they'd show up. So that kind of thing happens a lot.
And you're always drawing from life very much, you know, to kind of get those first ideas of a way to get into somebody's head.
Right. And I just watch, you know, and then some people show back up and others don't.
I'm guessing most of those are happy accidents. You actually don't go out to stalk people.
No.
Have you ever followed anybody? Like, you're really interesting enough for me to even get another look.
You know, I don't think that I have. Again, because I'm a weenie. I'm just too scared to do that kind of thing. But I certainly have wanted to. Yeah. I have wanted to follow somebody and see where they were going.
Isn't that what you do with your story?
Yeah. You're exactly right. So I go home and I write it down instead. but I can't follow people on the street.
Well, you know, it's a skill.
Yeah, apparently.
It's also a chargeable offense.
I know. Exactly. So, like I said, I'm just...
Did you ever consider journalism because you're so fascinated with an honest rendering of people?
You know, I did consider journalism for about 3 weeks.
That's a good length of time.
Yeah. In college, Patty Hearst had occurred. The story of Patty Hearst had just happened, and I was fascinated with that. And I thought, oh, well, I'll be a journalist, and I'll uncover that. And that lasted about 3 weeks. And then I just went back to thinking, no, I think I'll wait for, you know, do fiction. I'm not going to wait for Patty to get arrested or whatever was going to happen to her.
So this is a warning, you know, as you get your book signed today, don't be too interesting. Or when you get the next book. You've been warned. Also, another thing I find interesting is you write your first drafts, maybe your full drafts, still by hand, the way you did when you first wrote in those notebooks.
Well, I will write, yes, I will write scenes by hand, and then I'll put, you know, type them into the computer and print them out.
Okay.
And then I'll mess them up just as quickly as I can, because I really like, I like my desk to be messy. I like...
What do you like about that? What do you like about disarray?
I don't know. I've always liked mess. Not dirt, but mess.
And as you write, you're surrounded by debris. You have piles that you work from in both New York and Maine.
I have all sorts of papers, and you know, I just don't even know what most of them are half the time. I really don't. But every so often I look through them and I think, oh, yeah, look, right. Look, oh, yeah, okay. Let's think what she can do.
There's the mortgage.
Yeah. Right. But that's how I work.
These imaginary towns, I believed them so much, I looked them up for this tonight. I was like, well, I'm gonna look up this place in Maine. I'm gonna look up this place in Illinois. And I was disappointed to find out that they didn't exist there.
Yeah.
Because they do now.
Yeah, they do. Thank you.
I hope there's people doing a tour. This is where we think it might be. That barn looks familiar. But you went to Illinois a lot for Lucy Barton.
We did. My husband and I went out there a few times, and I've been out there before, but he and I made some trips and drove around for a number of days on a couple of different occasions and really, really studied everything that we saw.
Did you stop and take notes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, I didn't. I took notes. You know, I don't actually take real notes. I mean, I might write down a couple of things, but it's funny how much what I see will stay with me. Hmm.
Yeah, I can't get away without journalism. They say, you know, we need proof.
I know.
But did you go there during winter as well as summer? Because you have the spring soybeans and corn.
We went there in November. We had Thanksgiving at a congregational church, just like Lucy Barton does.
Yeah.
That was interesting.
I always found it interesting that when you wrote Abide With Me, you church hopped for a while.
I did.
For almost
really
2 years,
did.
Right?
Oh, for a number of years I church hopped.
To get your main character in a congregation
to figure
right.
out what it would feel like to be a minister. And, you know, I was just very interested in the whole church situation. So
did you sit in the back?
I always sat in the back. Yes, I did. And then when somebody would eventually approach me, I knew it was time I had to leave.
Hand them a dollar and run?
No, I mean, I just, you know, they would see me and they would be like, hi, you know, and I'd say, uh-oh.
Yeah. What were you thinking in the back of that room? You had to sit through an entire, you didn't leave early.
Oh, no, I loved it. I was very, very interested. I'm still very interested in church services and what is trying to occur and how different they all are. And every church seems so different. So I was very interested in it. And I appreciated the, you know, the welcome. It's just that I didn't want to join every church. I went to, you know, I just wanted to observe.
Yeah, it'd be a lot of... A lot of emails.
Yeah.
So much of your work seems seeded in childhood. I mean, it's based in something deeply rooted in early experiences that either echo beautifully later or horribly later. What is it so much that you think is us from childhood? Do you think there's an essential core that defines so much about our later life?
Well, you know, Louise Gluck, I just... spoke to somebody at the Atlantic about this, but Louise Glick, the poet, has this fabulous line that says, we look at the world once in childhood, the rest is memory.
Hmm.
Isn't that wonderful? We look at the world once in childhood, the rest is memory. And, you know, ever since I read that line, whenever it was, I can't even remember, but I just was so struck with how true that was and how interesting that was. So. So I think that fiction is trying to get back to those more primitive feelings that we have in childhood that we get knocked out of us as we get older. You know, our parents try and make us civilized, and they should, but nevertheless, you know, we have those thoughts that maybe we think we shouldn't have, and yet other people have them too, so that's what fiction can do.
Do you think innocence gives you a certain freedom in imagination that hasn't been corrupted
yet? Yes, I think the language hasn't been corrupted yet. So that the first impression is about as true as you're going to get, probably.
What I find interesting about memory is that when you have when you observe something as a child, and then years later you remember it, you record the memory over the actual memory.
Right.
And if you remember something a lot, you keep recording over it as if you probably don't VCRs. We don't have these problems anymore, but back in the day when we had hair like this, we had VCRs. And there was something about that which I always found interesting, because it becomes less and less the actual observation and more and more the influences of where you are now change that. You can take a wonderful moment and it becomes horrible over time based on who you become in your life. And I think it's interesting how how characters in your stories are always contending with a secret which is their own.
Right.
Sometimes they don't even know it.
Right, exactly. Well, that would be most of us.
How do you come up with their secrets? What is the secret where you're like, oh, that's the one?
I don't know. I mean, the characters show up first because people are so interesting to me. I always start with people, so it's always a character that I start with, and then I just sort of poke around and play around with the character, and then I realize, oh, her mother might have. Got it.
What is it about mothers?
Oh, I don't know.
What is it about fathers?
Fathers. You know. Yeah.
I read these as incredible warnings to my to my parentage.
You should.
After I read your new book, Anything Is Possible, which I question a little bit, because I've been trying to breathe fire for like 35 years. It doesn't work. I've tried everything. So not everything is possible.
I understand.
But this new book is such a warning call for parentage. I have two daughters, and so I'm always thinking, how is Lucy Barton going to write about this? Because now I have to worry really, about you kind of forget the contributing factors of everything you do. If you're angry, and someone spills the milk, and suddenly you have an outburst, it doesn't matter to you. But to a child,
to them,
it's an incredibly traumatic moment, which
of course
they store and you forget.
That's right.
And these things build up.
Don't forget it.
I don't. No. Thanks.
Yeah. Anytime.
But Little House on the Prairie comes up in these stories as well, which of course is the child in the wilderness story, is Hansel and Gretel of sorts, even though it's a family unit. Mm-hmm. What books did you love when you were that age?
You know, I don't really think that I read children's books. I did read the Little House on the Prairie books, but and they were fine. But I honestly don't remember reading children's books that much. I just think I went straight for the grown-up books because that's what was around. I remember reading Updike's Pigeon Feathers when I was 6 or 7 years old because it was on the coffee table, and that was interesting. I'll tell you. I mean, I didn't really get it, but I did sort of get that being a grown-up was like a lot more interesting than being a kid. That's what I took away from that experience.
And have you ever thought about writing a children's book? Because so much of this begins in childhood.
No.
What I love is your certainty.
Yeah.
No. You've gone back to Maine. Obviously, your husband loves Maine and is from Maine. You escaped to New York from small New Hampshire towns and the Maine towns that you write about with such detail. But even though I know you go back with him to that same place, is there an urge at all to go back there, like you want to?
Yeah, sure there is. There always has been. There always has been. As soon as I got out of it, I had a slow, low boiling nostalgia for it all the time that I lived with. And it was not an unpleasant feeling. And I would go back, you know, but I wasn't of it anymore in a certain way.
Your work is so conscious of nostalgia in that it discards it. It works very hard not to be sentimental, even though it's full of these emotional things, which would trigger sentimentality.
Right.
How do you guard yourself against that when you feel something? How do you know when something is sentimental and say, oh no?
Right. Well, I've always thought that sentimentality means, for me, it means a shortcut.
Right, you said that.
So if I feel that I've not earned the emotion in the book, then it's sentimental and it gets tossed aside. But if it's direct and yet earned, then I could go with it.
And you've said you're a messy writer.
Yeah.
Give us a picture of your writing studio. What does that look like in there?
Well, it has a thrift shop couch, flowery old couch, and it has a thrift shop pink chair, fabulous. And it has a table, and it has papers stacked around. What more would you like?
Oh, no. I'm just thinking, with these piles, much of it probably handwritten pieces of
material. Lots of
material.
Handwritten stuff.
How do you find the one you're missing?
Well, I don't always. And that's...
You're just constantly shuffling? The piles rise and fall?
Yeah,
change.
They rise and fall. I don't know what they do. They just do their stuff. But I don't always find what I'm looking for. But then I do. Because when I wrote Olive Kittredge, I wrote the last page of that book without having written the story before it, or without even knowing that the story would be written, but I saw that image, and so I wrote that down, and I wrote end with a question mark on the top of it, and I found it like a year or two later when I wrote this story, and I thought, wait a minute, there's an end. I have the end of this story. I have the end of this book, and I found it.
Where do you store all the pieces that you've used? Do you have an archive of sorts? I know you're not a file person.
No, I just throw them away. Yeah. Easy, throw that stuff away. Yeah.
It's got very sad.
No, it's not. No,
I'm
it's
a complete
not.
Opposite. I have exactly the same organizational plan, which is disarray, except that I keep everything.
Right.
So
that's a problem.
They have a show about it.
Yes, they do.
Eventually, they come and try to find me.
Yes, exactly.
But organization, you also defy the organization of chronology. You don't follow a timeline.
Right.
And is that because we think by association, we don't think by time? Is that also kind of how you write?
It is how I write. I mean, I write what I need to write, and then I think about it later, basically. So I'm just always writing, different scenes, and then they'll sort of coalesce in some ways. Or if they don't, they go on the floor and they get tossed out. That's fine. Mm. So you can throw things away. Yes, you can. But anyway, all right. So
I'll save your stuff.
No, you. Nope. But according to the story that I'm writing, I mean, like, The Burgess Boys is much more traditionally straightforward. It has a certain
right.
beginning, and it goes backwards a little bit to let people know what's happened, but that's a more traditionally straightforward narrative because the story calls for it.
And when you were writing My Name is Lucy Barton, you wrote many of the stories which are now in Anything is Possible.
That's right.
Because they were...
At the same time. I wrote those two books.
Those characters were occurring.
At the same time.
Right. Did you know that those were going to be another thing, or were they things you wrote in support of Lucy Barton which you realized weren't strong enough or necessary for Lucy's story at the time?
No, they were never going to be part of Lucy. They were never going to be in that Lucy book. I mean, Lucy has her own voice, and that
right.
was going to be that. But I was trying. I wanted them to be partner pieces in a certain way. But you don't need to read either one. I mean, you can read them separately.
Right.
But there are reverberations, of like the war. The father in
right.
Lucy Barton has been so traumatized by the war, and there's a character in Anything is Possible
mm-hmm.
who's later been traumatized by the Vietnam War. So there are certain reverberations I wanted to be happening. But I was writing them at the same time that I was writing My Name is Lucy Barton. A lot of them I was.
That's fascinating that you're kind of, the same environment was producing all these different storylines. Yeah. And I think it's really fascinating also about how you examine a town is that you almost come at it from a gestalt perspective. You see it from everyone's side of view.
Well, that's what, I mean, I'm so interested in point of view. I just, you know, the fact that we only see the world from our own point of view is, it's always made me so upset because I just want to know what it feels like to be another person, so I have to make it up.
And and at some point you even considered being an actress to inhabit other people.
Yeah, for about, 2 months in college.
Well, longer than you considered being a journalist.
Yes, oh, definitely longer than that, yeah.
And then Annie ends up being an actress, which is interesting.
Yes, that's right.
In this new collection.
That's right. Annie Appleby ends up being an actress, yep.
Even though you have an urge to go home, or at least to the place itself, and you still own the home you grew up in as well, right?
Well, I mean,
you live in Brunswick, but...
We live in Brunswick, but... there is still the home that I grew up in. I don't own it. My brother owns it.
Okay. But all your characters are warned almost to the last, don't come back. The people who have gotten away
are kind of giving this.
They come back and they're almost horrified.
Don't come back. Don't get married. You'll be miserable, her grandmother says. Well, that's her grandmother.
She's on a thrift shop couch in your writing room.
Right.
But
I mean, that grandmother, she just sits there and says, oh, I'd like to die.
Yeah.
So that's her story.
What was it? I think it was early on, Annie's excited. She's telling her about how she came back and said, you shouldn't look out. I learned something in her class. Like, you shouldn't look out at the snow when the sun's out because you'll go blind. The grandmother says,
then don't
look out.
Exactly.
She's very pragmatic.
that's Annie's grandmother.
Yeah. I think as you feel your way through a story, I know your greatest fear, you've told me, the thing you worry about most is that your work won't be good enough.
Right.
How do you kind of come to that point in your piece where you say, I'm going to make my peace with this. I feel it's done. I feel it does what it's required to do for an audience. Outside of my head now, I think it has a life of its own. I think it's good enough. How do you assign that? How do you let it go?
I don't know that I ever really do think it's good enough, but I realize it's the best I can do at that moment in my life, and so it will go. But I don't know that I ever think it's as good as it should be.
That's art.
It is art.
Do you ever read work have you read some of these books at readings and things like that and gone, or are you saying, what?
I don't really read them.
Ever.
not so much, particularly.
We do.
Yeah, I'm glad.
That's interesting, how your relationship to your work, once you've created
this thing.
Well,
it's done, and it's like, I just can't, it would make, whatever.
Yeah. have any stories come out of when working on like Olive Kittredge and even Amy and Isabel? Are any of those books also creating satellite stories of their surroundings, kind of like Lucy Barton did? Are there stories we haven't seen yet?
Well, Abide With Me, Catherine Caskey shows up in one of the Olive stories because I just sort of thought, she's a grown-up woman now, and so let's have her show up and be concerned about this other person. So that was fun, connective tissue like that. But no, they haven't really,
Probably threw them away.
They may be. They may be.
You have said, and I'm going to quote this, my parents came from many generations of New Englanders, and they were skeptical of pleasure.
Yes. They were skeptical of pleasure.
What pleasure did you have as a child that you remember? What thing that you're like, wow, if I could just have that, that would be great?
You mean what did I want to have or what did I have?
Yeah, well, what existed in your ecosystem that you could actually...
I had the whole world to be pleased with. I had the whole physical world to play in. And this was back in the days when, you know, the kids, you just left the door, you know, you just, kids just disappeared for the day, and if they came home alive, you were fine. Yeah. That's how I was raised, you know, so I would just go off and, and so I would just go off and play in the woods all day, and it was a fabulous kind of place to be alone in. It, there were toads and turtles and creeks and pine needles, and it was, you know, that was very, very pleasurable for me, really. So it wasn't until I was older that I, you know, began to understand my heritage, which was skeptical of pleasure.
Did you feel you were missing something later because you realized you were missing something that was available in the rest of the world, or did you know it then?
Well, I sort of knew it. You know, I mean, we didn't have a TV, and that was okay because, you know, we just didn't have one, but I certainly understood that other people had them and they would be talking about TV shows. That didn't really bother me. But, you know, I didn't go to the movies or, you know, and as I got older, I realized, oh, there is a world out there.
And you'd only seen two movies by the time you went to college.
Right.
It's not a lot.
No, I guess it's not.
You'd have to write a lot of stories in your head.
I did.
To make up for that.
I did.
What little pleasures did you enjoy?
Well, I really did enjoy being in those woods, and I think that as a young
like
person,
Annie,
right?
Who goes
and
off
as a young person, it was not a bad thing for me because I developed great inner resources, and a writer has to have very strong inner resources.
Yeah.
And those were developed quite young for me, I think.
And you were able to live in your head, which
yes.
is what a writer does all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
When did you become a keen observer of people? When did they first start drawing you out of your head and into their worlds and begin to wonder at them?
Yeah. As soon as I saw one. I was so
In Maine, there's not a lot of people.
No, there's not a lot of people up there. So, you know, oh my goodness, when I would go into town with my mother or something and my father would go in the car, I mean, I would just be so excited to just see people. I really liked seeing people.
Yeah.
And my mother would comment on the different people that we saw walking by, and she was just always so interesting, her remarks. And so I was always fascinated by people.
Mm.
And I really, really just love seeing people around.
Is part of the fascination that anything is possible in their life? I mean, they could
yeah.
be anybody.
They could be.
Which we find out every time you're right.
But it's so true. I mean, yeah, there was a man in our building who I had a whole story about him, about, you know, he had some tragic ill wife or something and this and that, and actually he's got the perkiest little wife in the world, and he's happy as a clam. I mean, I just couldn't have been more mistaken.
Yeah. At least that's what he shows you.
I know.
Because all these stories,
I know.
There is always this incredible secret, and sometimes it's not even a secret, but
yeah.
What I love is how you examine it from everyone else.
Right.
Like the
right.
fact that other people know your story when even you think they don't.
Right.
And then you find out later their version of your life, which is kind of how, you know, Lucy
yeah.
feels that, and Annie feels
yeah.
that. All these characters coming back to their hometowns are
right.
given a new story of what they lived through.
Right.
And they're shocked.
Right.
Like Lucy can't even handle it. Right.
Right.
It's interesting.
But that is this point of view, and like I said, point
right.
of view is always fascinating to me, that we, especially in a small town, we think that we know one person, and we do sort of, but not really, because we never really fully know anybody, and then,
right.
but we think we know this person, and then, you know, there's another person who knows that person, but not really the same person that we think we know that person, you know, it's also interesting.
Yeah, and you just keep on
pivoting. Yeah, keep on going around.
Circling. Yeah. Are there words that you can't stand? Like, as you're writing, like, I will not use that word, even
yes.
though it's the right word.
I don't like the word delighted.
Delighted. And is there a story born of that?
Well, when I was in law school, there was a woman I knew, and I remember how she would say, it was just delightful. I was delighted with it. And I didn't like the way she said it. And I realized later it was a false sentence.
Hmm.
She just was being false, as many people are. But she really struck me as like, and I've always remembered delighted, delightful. I just can't get it out of my ears, that sound of her phoniness about it. So.
And that's one thing that you can't stand in writing. Even, you know, fiction doesn't matter what it is, there's always the need for absolute honesty. Your characters have to tell the truth.
They do.
And so that would make it impossible, really, for you to, you know, some people lay out their story. I know how this ends, and I know how I'm going to progress there. But you don't, because your characters have to do what they're going to do.
That's right. That's right. I have no idea what they're going to do. I mean, when Olive Kittredge stole her daughter-in-law's bra, I had no idea that she was going to do that. And that was a very fun day at work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how did that come to you?
Well, I just thought, okay, Olive, let's see what we're going to do here. And so she's standing there, and she gets up off the bed, and she's standing next to her son's bureau. And I thought, oh, bureau, let's open the drawer. So she opens the drawer, and she sees all these bras. I thought, let's take one. It was so fun.
What are other fun moments that you can kind of remember writing them and thinking, I wouldn't have thought that. Except that I did.
I don't know, but you know, let me just go back to this bra stealing thing, because...
Is this a thing now?
Well, I just want to say that, you know, I don't have a daughter-in-law. I mean, I've never personally done that. But apparently there are people who want to. I'm just telling you.
Have people come up to you at readings?
I have been on the road with Olive, there have been women who have leaned in and whispered to me, how did you know? So I'm just saying there was something emotionally truthful about that scene, I guess.
Have you ever had anyone lean in, like an old farmer, and say, I burned the barn?
Not yet.
No, someday.
But this is just new. This book is new.
Someday.
So we'll see. Right. Oh, dear.
Do you stand by for truth?
Yeah.
Do you collect anything when you go places? I know you kind of enjoy travel for the movement of it, the newness of it, and the fact that you get to see new environments that you can draw from at
see
some
point.
See
the way the sun hits the buildings.
Yeah, but do you ever bring back mementos? Are you a keeper, other than the... obviously, the purging you do in your office. Are there things you kind of keep around you when you write?
No.
In your life?
I'm so sorry.
I really think you should be.
I am. I really am. I feel like, but no.
No.
I don't bring back things.
Do you have objects from your childhood?
No.
Did you have objects when you were a child?
Well, that's the real question. No.
No.
No, there was nothing.
We played with rocks and we loved
it. We did.
It.
We played with rocks.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah.
I love rocks.
I know. I love rocks too. Yeah. But, No. Yeah. I mean, I have my daughter's toys.
Yeah.
In case she ever wants them. Not all of them, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. I have symbolic things like that.
Yeah.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, more of Benjamin Bush's conversation with novelist Elizabeth Strout.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Benjamin Bush's conversation with Elizabeth Strout.
When you're in New York, what reminds you of Maine? Do you ever walk down a street and have the presence of that distance in your day, despite the rush, despite the flow of people, despite the buildings? Does it ever creep in?
Well, I think Maine is always in me. Mm-hmm. I think it's just in me. It's just who I am. It's just so deeply, deeply who I am that, you know, it's there, even in the midst of the busy streets of New York, you know?
Is there a word you love, like if you could use it more, you would?
I love the word inimitable.
Inimitable.
Because I can pronounce it. And I know what it means.
Where did it come from? When did you first learn that?
I don't know. I have no idea where I first learned it, but it's I just like that word. I can't use it too often. You know, it's not a word you just throw around.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like tintinnabulation doesn't come up often.
No, no.
You went to law school at Syracuse, and
yeah.
And that was a disaster.
Was a disaster. I went to law school because, you know, I always knew that I was a writer. I understood that I was a writer, but I went to law school because nobody else seemed to understand that I was a writer. That's true. You know,
yeah.
I just sent out stories all the time and nobody was even remotely interested. And so after cocktail waitressing and doing all sorts of jobs, I finally went to law school. And then I dropped out of law school and I wrote a really bad novel. And I worked in a department store in Syracuse, and it turned out I couldn't even sell very well, so they kept moving me up the floors until I was on the level of mattresses. Sixth floor mattresses. Yeah. Just me and the mattresses.
And it was kind of like being back in Maine.
It was pretty depressing up there with the mattresses. And once in a blue moon, somebody's come in and say, what's a good mattress? I said, I don't know. Try them. And so after that.
You didn't lie in them, try them yourself?
No, I just.
You stood in a room of mattresses?
I actually did, yes. Isn't that funny? I did. I was young.
Yeah. You're very dutiful.
Now I would, you know, lie down in a heartbeat, but I stood. But then I quit. The point is, I went back to law school. The mattresses did me in. And I just said, okay, I've got to go back to law school and finish up. So I did. And I got a gerontology certificate at the same time because I was interested in older people. And I thought, well, you know, I'll do something with older people in law. And I didn't. But I was a lawyer for 6 months, even though I was doing, you know, work that I sort of believe. I mean, I did believe in the work. It was for legal services. I was the head of what they called the developmentally disabled unit at that time. And my job was to take my clients before administrative law judges and explain why their benefits should be renewed or whatever. And I just failed again and again and again. I just failed. It's horrible. It was just horrible.
But you learned a lot about people in that state. And has that experience come back?
I kept thinking, for years I kept thinking, boy, that was a really strange turn in the road. Why in the world did I do that?
Yeah.
But then I realized, you know, it made some sense. There was an MFA program at Syracuse at the same time that I was there. And when I dropped out of law school, it would have made sense because I knew the writers in the program. And it would have made sense for me to have switched over to that. And I didn't. And I think about that sometimes, how I went back to law school. And I think that going back to law school was actually better for my writing. Because it made the law training, I mean, my lawyer skills were horrible, of course. But my law training helped me to cut through a lot of the excessive emotion that I had.
And get to the truth.
And get to the truth of it. I really do think so. And then with the Burgess Boys, I was able to understand the legal ramifications as well.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not sorry that I went to law school.
A lot of your older characters have such trauma somewhere in their lives that they're disguising or compensating for or dealing with openly. And so I always, you know, wonder how do you get in those heads for prolonged secrets, these things which seem to carterize and just do so much damage inside. You always are attracted to those characters, and they're just so full of this powerful memory.
It's dramatic on the page. It's like I keep thinking about when Eugene O'Neill wrote that one play, All Wilderness, about a happy family, and it flopped because nobody was particularly interested in going to the theater and watching this happy family. And, so if you're interested in what I'm interested in, then you'll be, whatever. I'm just saying that it's dramatically interesting for me to go with my writerly tools into those areas of the human experience.
Besides writing, do you have any compulsions? Like just things you're drawn to do? Go ahead, say no.
No, I'm not going to. I dare say no. I've been saying no all night.
It's an odd question, but I always wonder, I have so many fixations that I just wonder if other people do.
I really like to play the piano.
Really?
Yeah, and we have a piano in Maine and a piano in New York, and I really I am drawn to it. There's a physical urge that I have to play the piano.
Does that rhythm, that motion, both tapping keys to type but also to play, does that kind of affect the sound of your sentences, do you think?
I don't know. I studied the piano ever since I was very, very young, and I had a really strict teacher, and he would sweat through shirts during the lessons, and he would yell up the stairs for his wife to bring him a new shirt because he had sweat through his shirt, yelling at me about couldn't I hear it. And he was great. I realized he taught me to pay attention to two-note phrases, the Mozart two-note phrases. He kept saying, can't you hear it? And I couldn't, and I could, and then I finally could. So I think, I think there are times when I'm writing, I realize I thank him so much for that training, because he wouldn't stop it. He wouldn't let me go. He wouldn't let me off.
Isn't that the most common thing you hear parents say to their children, is pay attention? It's constantly, I feel like I'm saying that so many times, pay attention to your food.
Yeah.
Pay attention.
Well, he was saying a lot more than pay attention.
You have to do it if you're going to sweat through your shirt, I think.
Yeah. He was a little more engaged than that.
Wow. Did you see the movie Whiplash?
No.
Yeah, okay. Well, you might have traumatic memories if you do. You've also said you can't write fiction and be careful.
I don't think you can write the kind of fiction that I'm trying to write and be careful.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that a fiction writer has to go those places that ordinary lives don't enter, except they are experiencing them, but they don't look at them. Mm. So when I'm saying don't be careful, I'll give Olive Kittredge as an example. I can remember when I was working on her thinking to myself, oh, whoa, I've got to stop this. She's really, she's too much. And then I remember telling myself, no, let her be Olive. And I remember exactly where I was when I understood that, let her be Olive. And so I have to let her be Olive because she is Olive. And so I have to stand back and let her be that. And so that's not being careful. Because there was a tendency to protect her and the reader from her. Say, ooh, wait a minute, Olive, let's just calm down here. But Olive doesn't calm down. So what's the point of writing about her if we're not going to let her be?
Yeah, and you need something terribly fierce to inhabit that character, and you got Frances McDormand.
Yeah.
What did you think of all that?
I thought she was great. I thought she was just wonderful. I thought Richard Jenkins was fabulous. Yeah.
How is it to see something which was so clear in your own mind adapted and then adapted again? Because, first they have the script, which is not exactly the book.
I inhabit it with
people who aren't the people you imagined.
Right.
How was it experiencing that, where you're kind of they can't get it right, but they can get
a good job.
Feeling right.
It was very, very weird because it was just so strange because I kept thinking, oh, I'm watching this movie and, I know that. Well, I actually wrote that. But then I would be back into just watching a movie. So it was like this weird in and out thing. Mostly I was outside of it. But once in a while I would think, oh, no, I know that. I know that. I wrote that. It was so weird. But mostly, I just felt like I was watching a movie.
And Amy and Isabel?
Yeah, similar.
Yeah? That's so interesting. I always wondered how it would be for that kind of,
It's just it's a whole different kind of experience.
Okay. And I guess, have you ever written someone who frightened you? Like, really, you couldn't even believe you were imagining them and the things that they did?
Well, that story cracked. And anything is possible.
Yeah.
He's a little creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was okay with me. Mm-hmm. I mean, he didn't frighten me, but he would have if I'd written a whole book about him.
Yeah.
But I just had one story about him.
I would love for you to read something from Anything is Possible.
Oh, okay. I'll read from, I'm not going to read about the creepy man. but I'll just start at the very beginning and then, because Tommy Guptill is so not creepy. I shouldn't say that because you all make your own decisions, but anyway, I'll just read a couple of pages of Tommy Guptill. Tommy Guptill had once owned a dairy farm, which he'd inherited from his father, and which was about 2 miles from the town of Amgash, Illinois. This was many years ago now, but at night, Tommy still sometimes woke with the fear he had felt the night his dairy farm burned to the ground. The house had burned to the ground as well. The wind had sent sparks onto the house, which was not far from the barns. It had been his fault. He always thought it was his fault, because he had not checked that night on the milking machines to make sure they had been turned off properly, and this is where the fire started. Once it started, it ripped with a fury over the whole place. They lost everything except for the brass frame to the living room mirror, which he came upon in the rubble the next day, and he left it where it was. A collection was taken up. For a number of weeks, his kids went to school in the clothes of their classmates until he could gather himself and the little money he had. He sold the land to the neighboring farmer, but it did not bring much money in. Then he and his wife, a short, pretty woman named Shirley, bought new clothes, and he bought a house as well, Shirley keeping her spirits up admirably as all this was going on. They'd had to buy a house in Amgash, which was a rundown town, and his kids went to school there instead of in Carlisle, where they had been able to go to school before, his farm being just on the line dividing the two towns. Tommy took a job as the janitor in the Amgash school system. The steadiness of the job appealed to him, and he could never go to work on someone else's farm. He did not have the stomach for that. He was 35 years old at the time. The kids were grown now, with kids of their own who were also grown, and he and Shirley still lived in their small house. She had planted flowers around it, which was unusual in that town. Tommy had worried a good deal about his children at the time of the fire. They had gone from having their home be a place that class trips came to. Each year in spring, the fifth grade class from Carlisle would make a day of it, eating their lunches out beside the barns on the wooden tables there, then tromping through the barns, watching the men milking the cows, the white foamy stuff going up and over them in the clear plastic pipes, to having to see their father as the man who pushed the broom over the magic dust that got tossed over the throw-up of some kid who had been sick in the hallways, Tommy wearing his gray pants and a white shirt that had Tommy stitched on it in red. Well, they had all lived through it. This morning, Tommy drove slowly to the town of Carlisle for errands. It was a sunny Saturday in May, and his wife's 82nd birthday was just a few days away. All around him were open fields, the corn newly planted and the soybeans too. A number of fields were still brown as they'd been plowed under for their planting, but mostly there was the high blue sky with a few white clouds scattered near the horizon. He drove past the sign on the road that led down to the Barton home. It still said sewing and alterations, even though the woman, Lydia Barton, who did the sewing and alterations, had died many years ago. The Barton family had been outcasts, even in a town like Amgash, their extreme poverty and strangeness making this so. The oldest child, a man named Pete, lived alone there now. The middle child was 2 towns away, and the youngest, Lucy Barton, had fled many years ago and had ended up living in New York City. Tommy had spent time thinking of Lucy. All those years she had lingered after school alone in a classroom. From fourth grade right up to her senior year in high school, it had taken her a few years to even look him in the eye.
And that sets us up for an entire adventure through this entire book of everyone else. So thank you so much. I think it's a great time to open up questions from all of your readers. And someone will go around with a mic. You just put your hand up.
I love your stuff.
Oh, thank you.
I'm a graphic designer, and I find that when I'm working on a project, I tend to go into a zone.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you experience that, and then when you come out of the zone and read your stuff, do you sometimes go, wow, where did that come from?
You know, yes, I do know that feeling. It doesn't happen all the time at all. But I understand that feeling. There are times when I'm completely inside the work, and then later look at it and think, oh, look at that. It's not my ordinary day at work. My ordinary day at work is like, oh, come on, let's try and find this, you know. But yeah.
Here in the middle.
I, when you came out as kind of an international or nationally known author, when did that happen to you, and what was it like when that was happening?
Right. I think that happened to me with Olive Kittredge having won the Pulitzer Prize, and the first time I was aware of it was when I was in Italy. And the Italians love me. They love my work, and I didn't know that. And then I learned that. And I was in a festival, at a book festival in Italy, and my editor said, well, you know, we're not going to go to the venue we thought we were. And she just calmly walked me over, because, you know, I had terrible stage fright back then, especially, mm-hmm. and everything. And so she walked me over to this huge outdoor space, and there were people, like,
Coliseum.
Hanging. You know, what?
It was the Coliseum.
Well, kind of. Yeah, it was, basically.
Lions.
You know. Yeah, it was the Coliseum. No, that was a different time. But there were a lot of people, and it was an odd experience because I was being translated. You know, I was answering questions, and then these impassive faces, and then, you know, a few moments later there would be some sort of response. But that was very, very moving for me to realize. And then when people came up afterwards, this one woman said in Italian to the translator, and she says to tell you, you've seen into her soul. And I just thought, oh, I can die now. This is so, I mean, it was wonderful. So I've always remembered that one experience in Italy with Olive Kittredge when I felt that. I've, you know.
And there's a story in Italy in this new collection.
Yeah.
Did that come from maybe some of that time there?
It did. Well, yes, it did come from some of that time there.
Yeah.
Not during that particular visit, but.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to Traverse City.
Thank
from
you.
Michigan Writers. I did a little reading on your background and saw that you had taken stand-up comedy through the New School in New York. Can you say a little bit about why you did that?
Oh, I did it because I had been writing and writing for years, and I just didn't understand why my writing wasn't working better. I really didn't understand it. And I thought to myself, there must be something that I'm not being honest about, and I couldn't figure it out. And so then I realized that with comedy, people laugh at something because it's true. So then I thought, I wonder what would come out of my mouth if I put myself into that kind of pressure cooker. What would come out of my mouth? What would be true? If I had the audience right there and I was responsible for making them laugh, what would I say? So I signed up for a class at the New School. And it was terrifying. It was terrifying. And every week somebody else would drop out. Because, you know, we were all so frightened. But those of us who made it through for our final exam had to perform at the comic strip on 82nd Street. And I did. And it was through my routine, which I made a great deal of fun of myself, you know, through that routine. And that was when I understood that I was a white woman from New England. I did. Yeah, really did. Oh, and then I started to write Amy and Isabel.
Yeah.
So it worked. But it was terrifying. Oh my goodness.
A number of years ago, a book group that I was in selected Abide With Me. And we read that and I got hooked. And I've read all your books since. And I plan to read Amy and Isabel next. My question is, you've written about some very memorable women in your novels. I'm wondering which one of those women reflects most who you are.
Right. Okay.
And then she had to tell the truth.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking about this. You know, I'm not trying to dodge this. I'm really not. Or maybe I am. Who knows? But there's a part of me in all of them every single character, but there's a part of me in every male character I write as well. So who is most representative of me as a female character? You know, I just go through them and I can see the pieces of myself that I've used for each one, but I don't know that any of them are any more representative. I think all of them are representative of me in some way. I can't say that one is more representative of me, actually, because they all use different parts of myself.
It's a memoir in true lies.
Yeah.
It's great.
Hello.
Hi.
I know you probably get this question a lot, but do you have any, you know, advice for aspiring writers?
Yeah. Here's what I think you should do. I think you should read good stuff, meaning, you know, the classics, but read good sentences, because it's like eating good food. And if you don't read good sentences, then your mind isn't going to be recording good sentences. So read the classics, read the good sentences. I don't care how different they feel from what you want to do, just read all the good sentences that you can find, and then write. Just read and write and read and write, and you'll get better, because you just will. And just watch and listen and have fun, you know, on the page. But read good sentences and then write constantly. Just do it, do it, do it, do it. And I don't think you should necessarily tell anybody. Well, you just won your prize. But
yeah, it's too late for you.
It's too late for you. But I would caution people, you don't have to tell anybody that you're up to this. That's my New England background.
Or you can or you could go to law school and then practice for 6 months.
Do you feel as if every human you could encounter would be interesting, or do you think there are certain people where you get to know them and you think there's nothing there?
You know, that is exactly,
exactly.
And you know, for years I had a friend in college, and we would argue this, the way people in college, you know, they just have nothing to do, so they sit around and talk about that kind of stuff all the time. And we would, you know, his position was, there are people that are boring. And my position was, no, there are not. And I still stick with my position, although every so often I think, I don't know. You know, he might be right. But I still don't think so. I still think if you can get in far enough, there's got to be something interesting in every person. But I'm not sure that that's
everyone's interesting
true.
For at least a short story, but don't live with them. And with that, I think we've had a wonderful evening together.
Thank you so much.
Elizabeth Strout.
That was Elizabeth Strout talking with Benjamin Bush. Elizabeth Strout's latest novel is Anything is Possible. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerrick.